Hey team, you're about to experience my interview with Nick Halusa from Nautical. Nick is the co-founder and CEO of Nautical, and Nautical is a marketplace platform for e-commerce merchants. It allows e-commerce merchants, whether that be B2C, D2C, or B2B, to establish a marketplace platform where they become the epicenter of a specific vertical or a type of products, and they want to create a multi-vendor sales opportunity for perhaps their dealers, their distributors, their wholesalers, or they just want to dominate a specific vertical and create an endless aisle experience for their customers. I learned a ton about all the extra challenges that come with helping to build a headless marketplace like Nautical. They feature a whole bunch of technology and concepts that allow merchants to get up and running very, very quickly with their own marketplace platform. And I think you're going to really, really enjoy this interview. This is the E-Commerce Edge podcast with your host, Jason Greenwood. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the pod. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Nick Halusa from Nautical Commerce to the podcast. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you. Love to be here.
Mate, it's so cool to have you along for the ride. I actually have been trying to feature Nautical on this podcast, I think, for about 6 months now. And we just haven't. So I've been working with the marketing team, and then I saw the team again at B2B Online in Florida. And then you had a transition. I think you came in as CEO, outgoing CEO left. So I think there's been a few people transitions within the business. And so it just took us a little bit of time to get connected up. But I'm so glad to have you here.
Yeah, no, what do I owe the pleasure to for being chased for 6 months?
Look, I had seen a few different posts from you guys on LinkedIn talking about your technology, et cetera. And I had recognized, particularly because I focus so much on B2B e-commerce, I had really recognized that, particularly in the United States, not so much in ANZ yet, I don't think, but particularly in the United States for B2B merchants, a lot of them are wanting to implement e-commerce marketplaces to effectively create an endless aisle experience within their e-commerce experience. And a lot of D2C and B2B, B2C brands rather, have been doing this for a very long time. They want to monetize all that beautiful traffic coming to their website, and they don't necessarily want to hold stock on every single product that they sell, et cetera. And because you guys provide multi-vendor marketplace functionality, it seemed like a great fit to have a conversation about the state of the union.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the story that we come out with, which is, first of all, it's hard building a marketplace in the first place. I think we can get into that. But marketplace is obviously a fantastic way to increase depth and breadth of SKUs, which means higher order rates, which means higher repeat purchase rates, which means higher conversion rates, all of which are the, as you well know, are the bread and butter of a successful online business. Is you've got to get people coming to your store, and you've got to get them buying something that they want. And the trick is understanding your customer and being able to show them kind of the variation of what fits there. Let's call it psychographic profile. And so the marketplace business model as a result is doing super well. And we saw a lot of that during COVID, right? Which is that these marketplaces just consistently outperformed as people shifted over to e-commerce.
And you're one of the co-founders of Nautical. And if I look back across the trajectory of your career, you were in investment banking for a while. You've been into tech. I wouldn't necessarily look at your history and say immediately, oh, this guy's going to create a multi-vendor marketplace platform. So how did you even get to be in this space?
Yeah, it's a great question. So what is a little hidden by my background is the fact that I've accidentally ended up in commerce tech as a lifer now. So the investment banking stuff is pretty trivial. It was a little bit of retail, a little bit of industrials, which kind of set me a little bit on that path. But the fund I joined, which at the time was super early, we were really just starting out. We were somewhere in the boonies of Greenwich, Connecticut, which is really, as a New Yorker, really is the boonies for us. And that was a fund specifically focused on commerce tech. So the fund had made its name a little bit before I joined on the roll-up Hybris iCongo, which ended up selling to SAP, which is now SAP Commerce Cloud. And the whole fund was built around what we used to call any technology that helps you make, move, or sell more stuff. So heavy commerce technology, I think fund one included a commerce platform called ShopKeep, which I was very close to at the time. Then in the fund one, we also invested in a company called NewStore, which I'm sure you're familiar with as well, which is the Demandware founder's newest commerce platform. They wear lots of stuff that fits into it. We did a little bit of offline commerce as well, which is not hot at the time, but I think was a little bit, it was good foresight to know that actually this offline stuff ain't going away as much as we're e-commerce people. And then a lot of sort of the apps that you see into that, I think that the big one that most people know from, for example, the first fund was a company called Forder, which is this Israeli fraud systems. I got dropped straight into the bleeding cutting edge of commerce and the investing side. Spent a bunch of time in the Bay Area at one of the portfolio companies. So I jumped over to one of the portfolio companies, which was effectively building marketplaces for logistics brokers. The idea being that super fragmented market, it's something that I'm sure you've seen a little bit of before. You go and take a logistics broker, it looks a lot like a marketplace, right? You're connecting all these shippers, you're connecting all these buyers, all these truckers, all these suppliers. And much like a B2B marketplace, you're doing a lot of services on the way, right? You're trying to make sure that you can manage all the finances, add all the extra services, a little bit white glove. So I both ran all the supply part of that marketplace. So all the software all the truckers would use, all the carriers would use, and then start a lot of the product for our marketplace model. So that's where I started touching this B2B marketplace problem. So when I went back to investing, this was obviously my focus, right? Which is B2B commerce, marketplaces, and everything that fits into that tech stack, because we had to build huge amount of this stuff ourselves. And the reason I'm here now is because when I went back to investing, it was the same damn story, right? Which is that all of the people we were talking to, especially who were building marketplaces, were building a huge amount for themselves, right? And the e-commerce problem to an extent was not solved, but most of it is abstracted away, right? You can get technology off the shelf, you can get going, you can build a business from it. And one of the things that I say that sometimes gets under people's skin is the fact that we still think of marketplaces as technology companies. And when I was investing, they were talking to us like technology companies, they were asking for money like technology companies, they were having to spend on expensive resources like developers, like a technology company. They're having to build expertise like technology companies in fintech and advertising and logistics and things like this. But they don't, of course, actually look like technology companies. They don't have 90%, 85% margin that you can use to subsidize your R&D. Our conclusion was that, conclusion from the venture side of things was somebody needs to figure out how to make this more accessible. Somebody needs to figure out how to make this a little bit more abstracted, right? Allow people to build marketplaces without having to become tech companies.
Why should brands need to build this stuff from scratch? And why should they become technology companies when they should be able to consume this product in a similar way to how they would consume Shopify or how they would consume BigCommerce or any other e-commerce platform? Why can't they consume this as a service instead of having to build all of this stuff bespoke and from scratch in-house or via an agency partner?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the other conclusion that we came to, which is, let's call it the more painful one, is the fact that somebody needs to build a full platform here. Because at the end of the day, when you run something like a marketplace, it changes everything you do as a store. Because one of the things that I often say is that as a marketplace, you don't actually sell anything, right? All you're doing is building a piece of real estate for other people to sell stuff in. And so the whole game is how you design this, what I call the birdcage, or let's call it the bowling alley, right, within which you have all of your suppliers, all your partners, all your community playing and doing things without them, let's call it, going off the well-trodden path that you want them to. And it's building something that is ground up, designed for that model, and doesn't just get people who run marketplaces to good enough or to functioning, right, which is much of the way that the off-the-shelf technology typically approaches this problem. Is you want to get them to thriving, but that means you really have to get into the meat of how digital commerce works and how the software works, and everything needs to be fiddled around with.
You've hit the nail on the head, and I think it's crazy. People that perhaps haven't helped brands onboard a marketplace engine of some variety into their business, they perhaps don't understand the complexity of trying to build a two-sided multi-vendor marketplace. It's just, there is so much to it in terms of the onboarding process, getting their products listed in the platform, making sure that there's non-duplication of products if you want to make sure that there's a central product, but multi-sellers of the same SKU, same product, using the same product details, the same product attributes. You then have the different commission structures or different rev share structures. You have the payout methodology. You have the checkout methodology and the payment methods that you want to make available to buyers as well. You have effectively a scenario where if I've got five items in my cart and they come from five different vendors, then I have to effectively create five sub-orders underneath that master order that gets parceled out and either sent to those particular sellers via CSV or via API or via EDI, depending on how they want to receive those orders and fulfill those orders. They then have to be able to push fulfillment data and product availability data and price data back into the platform. There is so much to this that it's easy to, if you say it quickly, it almost sounds simple. Oh, I'm going to go and build a marketplace. But it's anything but simple. It's pretty much the opposite of simple. You take building, for example, a customized implementation of a Shopify or a BigCommerce or a VTEX or whatever for a merchant selling D2C or B2C. And some people might compare that to building a marketplace engine. And it couldn't be further apart. It's basically like having the Grand Canyon between those two efforts, right? The effort to build a multi-vendor marketplace, particularly for B2B, if you want it to work in the B2B world, they are orders of magnitude more complex. And I guess one of my first questions to you would be, given that level of complexity and given the level of investment required to build a modern multi-vendor marketplace that would allow a brand, for example, or would allow a business to compete with the likes of Amazon if they wanted to, why would you do that? When we at that time, even 4 years ago, when you guys kicked off, we already had the Miracles of the world. We already had the Marketplaces of the world. We already had the VTEXes of the world and the Auras of the world that had either standalone marketplace technology or marketplace technology that was part of a dedicated e-commerce platform for brands. What did you see in the market that you said, we can do this better? We have to do this better, because there's some efforts out there. There's even some plugins and some apps for Shopify and other platforms. But you obviously saw an opportunity here that you said, there is a need not being met. And you must have been scratching an itch of some kind, given your investing background. So what was the trigger that said, sure, maybe there's some solutions out there in the market, but they're all pretty rubbish and we're going to fix it?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So first of all, I've got to commend you on your ability or your knowledge of the complexity of marketplaces. It's typically something that's a little bit hard to go and communicate to people. So if you ever decide to get out of the podcasting game, give me a call. And one of the things I want to say to what you were saying earlier is a really important point, and this will lead into the logic for building it like this, is all the things that you described, especially the work that you have to do with the supply side, so the vendors, is and let's call it expensive, that you have to go and handle or manage a bunch of vendors and a bunch of suppliers without being able to tell them what to do. Because when you have your own people and they do your own fulfillment and it's your own operations people, you can just tell them what to do. It's easy. You can solve most things with an operations plan, but you can't do that when you have all these suppliers. So that's conceptually expensive. And when you are a marketplace, you typically don't take as much per transaction, right? You might take 10%, you might take 15%. If you're really lucky and you're in certain markets, you can push up to 30%, but it's a pretty slim set. And so one of the things that I always try to hammer on people is this concept of marketplace math. You're trying to do more per order while getting less per order. And typically, you have to think about that as an automation problem. There's a technology problem, or at least me as a technology guy, that's the hat that I wear, is how do you bring technology to make people more efficient or be able to handle more orders, let alone all the stuff that you then have to do as a marketplace to go and get your take rate up, right? A higher take rate per order. And so what you end up with when you have a model where you try to take an underlying commerce system and you try to bolt things on the outside is, first of all, you're limited by what the underlying commerce system can do. And we can get into the nitty gritty of that. But fundamentally, Shopify is an incredible business. Shopify's business, for what they build, is not to go and service marketplaces or multi-vendor commerce systems. And so when they design something, when they make their roadmap, when they figure out particularly things like exception handling and issues, things like this, they're not designing towards the kind of customers that we work with, first of all. And second of all, you then get the issue that if you try to bolt two things together, that you are working in multiple systems. And This is a classic pain of the operators, right? The operator who actually is on the front line is trying to jump through hoops and saying, was the issue in the commerce system? Was the issue on onboarding the suppliers? Now try to combine the two. So was the issue maybe on the headless combination of where the commerce system and the multi-vendor app is trying to bolt together to get into the storefront? Is that the problem? Is it my special checkout that's a problem? So you're doing a little bit of whack-a-mole, trying to go from system to system. And then to what I was saying earlier around the marketplace math, and this is maybe a little bit of an abstract point, but the way that you can really succeed as a marketplace is to have fantastic oversight, right? Call it the control tower, the watchtower, right? The reporting across your system. And sometimes we talk about our system as being a little bit like a, if you remember the classic Domino's pizza tracker, right? Where you know where everything's happening along the way. And when you build a system from end to end, what you can provide to anyone who's not so incredibly technical that they can go and pull these systems together and try to build a unified view and try to build a unified operating procedure, you can start to give them a feeling of how they're operating and where their issues are and give them data around the entire life cycle of that order or the entire life cycle of their marketplace. And where that gets to is, of course, fantastic in the long run automation. And you can start to provide on the way other high value tools to that set of marketplaces as well, where you can start to say, hey, I can help you go and do more with that GMV. Let's talk about advertising. Let's talk about financing. And I know AI is hot right now, but in principle, AI as well. How did you end up with so much depth in the marketplace problem?
I think it's probably, first of all, you've covered a lot of the nuance in the marketplace model that brings the additional technical challenges and the operational challenges to businesses. And I guess for me, I've seen businesses go through this evolution where, particularly if they are a very large retailer, and I think probably my exposure to super marketplace heavy markets comes from having worked in ANZ for so long. And if we look at Australia in particular, it's probably one of, I like to call it, the most over marketplaced country in the world. I've never participated in any market anywhere in the world or worked with clients anywhere in the world that has as many competing marketplaces as Australia does. It feels like every single major retailer in Australia has their own marketplace. You know, you've got the Myer marketplace, you've got Bunnings has their marketplace, you've got just every major retailer plus all the standalone marketplaces like Catch. And of course, you've got Amazon there now. You've got eBay there. You've got the Iconic. You've got so many marketplaces operating in Australia that I guess I was exposed to that idea that, hey, we're a brand that is driving significant traffic to a web property to do commerce. Why wouldn't we want to, even down to Barbecues Galore, who I think it was about a year ago, launched their own marketplace after operating in Australia for many years without a marketplace, selling just their own products to the market. And I think what the conclusion that a lot of these brands came to is we're spending so much money nowadays to acquire traffic and acquire customers. And it is absolutely impossible to sell every single product that our customers may want on a 1P, a first person basis. It's just impossible. We can't do it. And so if we're going to be spending all this money to generate traffic and grow our brand and create loyalty and maybe even create a membership program, et cetera, to make our brand sticky with our customers and grow our database of customers and grow our email list, why wouldn't we want to effectively create an endless aisle of adjacencies around our product that effectively all of our co-sellers on our branded platform. So they really start to view their website as a brand platform more than an e-commerce platform, a platform of trust where people come and buy off them because they trust them. And so therefore they know, hey, if they already trust us for X, Y, Z item that they buy off us, why wouldn't they trust us to go and find sellers for item A, B, and C as well? And so we become the merchant of record, sure, and they may come back to us for customer service, et cetera. If we want to have, so let's say those brands have on average maybe 2 to 5,000 SKUs on their own website that they sell directly, they warehouse directly, they ship directly to their customers. If they want to get to 100,000, 200,000, 300,000, or a million SKUs, that is going to be flatly impossible as a single vendor. It's just impossible, right? And the costs to do so would be so high to warehouse that product, even if they're using a 3PL service. The costs are so high for fulfillment. And then if we get into a scenario where, okay, I'm just going to route the orders to my distributor to sell as a dropship item, I still have to own all of the product information around all these items. I still have to have all of these items in my ERP. I still have to have all of these items in my PIM system. I still have to maintain and own all the product data, all the pricing data, all the inventory data. I still have to own all of that. Even if I actually route the order to the distributor or the manufacturer to ultimately fulfill the good, there is a lot of responsibility when I'm directly selling items to consumers. When I go to a marketplace model, a lot of that complexity is abstracted away by the marketplace platform, right? And I can just effectively take my cut and monetize my traffic in a very light or low touch way. And so I guess to answer your question in a very long roundabout way, I saw these brands struggling with rising CAC costs, rising loyalty costs, right? So their cost structures were going through the roof, and yet they had to find a way to justify the expenditure of growing their customer base for items that they wouldn't necessarily ever sell themselves. And so creating that endless aisle experience, which they cannot do in their physical store estates, it's impossible for them to do. They can't do it. They can't carry a million items in their physical stores. And in fact, most retailers carry a small subset already of what they sell online in their physical store. So if, let's say it's a department store and they sell or they have available to them in their own inventory 50 air fryers, for example. They're all in their physical retail store. They're going to show 3 or 4 air fryers. They're going to show like a tenth of the inventory that they actually have available on their e-commerce website, selling directly themselves. I think what I've seen is evolution as these businesses have had to show more and better quality, sustainable profitability as a brand. Marketplaces are one of the only remaining ways they can expand their inventory without it costing them the earth to do.
There's so many points I want to, fantastic what you just walked through. There's so many points that I want to touch on. The first is I think you're right on the way to think about marketing, right? Which is the biggest expense, it's only getting more expensive. And one of the mind games that I like to play, which is I think technically incorrect, but it's a nice way of thinking about it, is to think of marketing and brand as a little bit of a fixed cost, right? You have to do it. You're spending all this money to keep your brand alive, to make it a thing. For some people, they even stick their brand on their intangible assets on their balance sheet as something that's on value. And you just have to do it nowadays, right? People have got to be familiar with your store. And so you're investing in all of this and you want to go and monetize it as much as possible. One of the most extreme examples, in my view, are actually car manufacturers, right? You go and spend your Porsche, right? You spend all this time telling people how cool it is to have a Porsche, and you're doing motorsport and you're doing all kinds of things, right? And then they buy one Porsche, your customer, right? And then on the way, who makes money? It's the people who sell you the oil and the special brakes and the seats and the whatever it is, right? They're all making money. And then you have to wait 5-10 years to sell somebody another car. And or the other people who make a huge amount of money are the people who then resell that car. Then suddenly Porsche is sitting there being like, man, I made Porsche cool. And then Bring a Trailer is making a bunch of money. Great business, by the way, Bring a Trailer. Well done. But Porsche doesn't see a cent of that. And to rethink about, first of all, how to go and monetize all that marketing you've done. And obviously the Silicon Valley tech companies are the ones who've done the best job of this. You buy an iPhone once, but you make money forever on the App Store and everything else. But you also, I think, are seeing a shift as a result to the way that people think about themselves, where to paraphrase what you said another way, is people think of themselves as serving now a psychographic profile as opposed to just selling a thing. And when e-commerce first happened, it was really very much about selling a thing. And because there weren't that many e-commerce stores, that was the expectation. But the world's, first of all, moved along in terms of the way that people buy. They want to build trust, they want to have content, they want to have something that speaks to them. And so the activities you do as an online store has changed, right? You're really telling a story around your goods, and you're telling a story to your customer. And then when you start to think about yourself as being a server of a psychographic profile of a particular demographic, you start to think, wait a second, I make a thing. These people are here to buy from me, not to buy my things. They buy from everything that I represent. And the most extreme version of that is the most brand-focused company in the world, Apple, I think is probably fair to say. And if you go into Apple Store today, you can buy all kinds of things. They sell Belkin on their website. And they sell, a friend of mine sells these wonderful little bee gardens called Eden through some of the Apple stores. And they've made this step of saying, you know what, we sell something incredibly valuable. We have all this brand, but we're still willing to effectively rent out our brand, our customer, to a community who share our values.
No, I think you're spot on. And in that scenario, obviously, Apple also licenses their brand to those manufacturers so that the likes of the Belkins of the world and this digital garden manufacturer, they, in order to say works with Apple or Apple authorized or Apple approved, in order for them to say that, they pay a lot of money to Apple for that privilege of using their brand as a halo over their product. And so therefore, Apple's winning in going both directions, right? Apple licenses their brand out for those manufacturers to manufacture those products underneath the brand halo. And then if they sell those products directly, they all also get the retail margin of selling those products, of being a retailer of those products. So they take 2 bites or 3 bites of the apple, so to speak, along the way, pardon the pun. And they've just done a really good job of monetizing the trust that consumers have in their brand. And I think that this is what is really most brands and the bigger retailers that are spending a lot of money on marketing and driving traffic and demand for their products, they are becoming masters at extending that brand halo over a broader set of products that they could never sell themselves. Now, I guess my next question to you is, I'm seeing brands be a little bit slower in considering a marketplace for their brand, right? D2C, we all know, we all admit that D2C and B2C are probably somewhere between 5 and 10 years, probably more like a decade ahead of where most B2B retailers are in terms of digital maturity, in terms of digital capability, in terms of digital strategy, in terms of e-commerce. For a lot of B2B brands, e-commerce for them is just EDI or maybe punch out. That's it. They don't really offer a self-service e-commerce experience today. And as a result of that, they don't really understand this whole monetizing the self-service crowd. They don't really know what that looks like. They don't know what shape that needs to take. And when they're looking at going online for the very first time from an e-commerce perspective, a self-service e-commerce perspective, they're staring down the barrel usually of a very long-term, very expensive, very complex e-commerce implementation that then needs to integrate with ERP and it needs to integrate with WMS and it needs to integrate with customer service and it needs to integrate with so many other systems to be able to do what it needs to do, that these projects, B2B projects, often look like a boil the ocean project, whether you want them to or not, just because they have to integrate with so many systems. And because in the B2B world, the data set is so much more complex, from individual price lists to trading terms to payment methods to credit limits and just every other thing you have to think about in the B2B world, it is so complex that it scares so many B2B businesses out of e-commerce, because they look at it and they go, this is too big, it's too expensive, it's too complex, we don't have the capability. So I guess I would love your take on where the B2B world is in terms of e-commerce generally, but more specifically with marketplaces, because I could see a world, I don't necessarily think this is going to become the norm, but I could certainly see a world where a lot of these B2B brands, they build on a platform like Nautical. They build their entire e-commerce solution on a platform like Nautical, and they become just one of the vendors on the platform itself, so that instead of building a separate e-commerce experience for them, that for their own direct sale products, and then building an endless aisle through a marketplace like you, they become just a vendor that retains 100% of the revenue through the marketplace themselves. So they're both the marketplace operator, but they're also a marketplace seller on their own marketplace that they operate. And maybe for some brands, that's how they get into e-commerce from a B2B perspective, because it's probably going to be easier for them to onboard into a marketplace platform that does a lot of the heavy lifting than it is for them to go to build a separate, effectively, B2B e-commerce platform where they sell to their B2B customers and then separately they try to take on this marketplace model. So I could see a world where that becomes the norm for a lot of brands. Hey team, have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening.
So I think my take actually would be that's a little further away from the manufacturer side. And the reason, I'm glad you pushed it towards B2B. The reason I always start with a B2C logic is because it helps people understand because they're buying it themselves. They're already in that world. I think people are used to that already. So taking that and then morphing it slightly and talking about the same concepts in B2B can be really helpful. I think there is a world for manufacturers to get into the marketplace world, but I think it looks slightly different. But let's start a little bit with distributors, right? So we spoke about psychographic profiles, right? Which is effectively saying, what does your customer buy? And in the B2C world, it's a little bit, except for the some people who actually go and do the research online, it's a little emotional. And in the B2B world, especially from distributors, it's not emotional, but it's very technical. And so you have somebody, they want to build a new factory line, they want to build a new house, they want to build all kinds of things like this. They are trying to build a list of requirements and hoping they can find somebody to go and service that. And quite frankly, the end customer, the more people that they have to find things from, the harder, the more people they have to vet, the harder, right? Because you really don't want to go, the last thing you want to do is go on Alibaba and absolutely scrape the bottom of the barrel, right? But you're trying to do something on time, you're trying to do something within budget. And so you're trying to find a supplier whom you respect and who you trust. And the more that supplier can go and fill that order, or as much of that order as they can fill, obviously the supplier wins, in this case, the distributor. And the more that you can have a predictable relationship as the person who's buying these things, who's working on that project. And so you're incentivized as a distributor to go and have a really, a very strong depth of catalog, also quality of catlog. And I think that the skew point is really important there, which I think we can pick up later. But at the end of the day, if your customer wants that strange Japanese screw that nobody else makes, you're not going to keep that in your warehouse. That would be insane. But you want to be able to offer it, right? And historically, a model has been for that drop shipping. But the reality is, and this is to your product management standpoint, is drop shipping, you still have to manage everything. And you still have to own the information. You don't know much about inventory, and because you actually don't really have much of a relationship with the end supplier. And the only way you can really scale that SKU depth and breadth assortment problem and make sure that the data remains correct and your understanding of inventory remains correct is if you start to build a community around your suppliers and your vendors, and you start to bring them into the fold. As the whole industry is getting more sophisticated and more online, you start to get to a world where they can participate. And look, participation early on, especially in the distributor world, is going to be, to your point, a little bit more old school, right? It's going to be EDI, it's going to be punch outs, XML, you name it. It's going to be emails being sent over, right? Here's my spreadsheet of what I've got, right? On a regular basis. You know, in the logistics world, it was all this. Nothing was tied together in the logistics world. Like the amount of time I spent digging through EDI codes and people's crazy butchering of EDI codes. When I was doing that, it looks very similar to the way that these distributors work, which is why I always think about them as very similar models. You're just sending services or lanes and not products. And that's model one, right? That's the distributor saying, okay, my job is to get this breadth and I'll offer it. And this is why some of these online folks have done really well, is in their ability to build that breadth and depth. And the big folks like Grainger have done this heavily, asset heavy, but that takes huge time and huge investment. And I think there's an opportunity for folks to go and catch up and do it in a different model, one that's less expensive. Right? And then you have small folks who are doing really well. There's a company called Volition, for example, is a wonderful B2B marketplace, who have said, you know what, I can do the same level of service and the same quality and the same depth by doing this in the asset light marketplace world way with a lot of help. And then there's another model, which is one that we have conversations with a lot of folks on, which is where manufacturers are involved, but slightly different. And I want to go again with this hat of the way that you should think about brand and psychographic profiles, which is that many big manufacturers, they work through their local distributors, for two reasons. One, that they have effectively a field sales force representing them, right? They have somebody standing there in Florida saying, hey, you really got to use this Honeywell thing. You've really got to use this, that famous valve company out of Italy, but they're like a field
or Grundfos pumps or whatever it might be. You've got to use this. You got to use this product that is absolutely perfect for your use case.
Yeah, exactly. And that's historically how the sales has been done, is why you have these deep channel relationships. And of course, it's also sometimes hard to move this stuff, right? A friend of mine has a lumber marketplace, right? Or it's a lumber distributor. And quite frankly, you're not shipping lumber from a central DC. No way. It's way too expensive. But where there's a big opportunity for manufacturers to start to get into this, right? Say, okay, let's not worry yet about them trying to sell other people's stuff, because that's not a motion that, there's not a cooperative motion that a lot of people are used to in this industry. And then figuring out, they all sell, a lot of these are big conglomerates, they all sell a little bit of other people's stuff, right? It's a little bit edgy, let's call it, to immediately make that cooperative. But what they can do is build a national, international brand and have a vendor network that's built out of their distributors. And maybe the best way to think about that, if you're not familiar with that, is if you buy from IKEA or Home Depot, right? You go in there and it says, where are you? And you say, I'm in this zip code. And it sends you to your local store, right? And your local store can actually give you advice, and they can provide services, and they can install for you and things like this. And your local store has business driven to them by the national brand, right? And so manufacturers have a big opportunity to say, okay, they want to build brands, of course, because if everything's made much cheaper in China, it makes a difference to have the Honeywell brand and the General Electric brand and everything else on the surface of it. They want to be able to build that reputation, but they've got to be able to go and justify that, right? They've got to justify all that marketing money. And if every time you go to honeywell.com and you can't do anything with that, okay, the pros will know what they're looking for, but there's a big opportunity to say, you know what, we'll help you buy something, but to be able to a little bit rethink that channel relationship and build a marketplace of all the local distribution partners that come into that. And then maybe the local distribution partners can have an opportunity to bring in other brands and things like this without the main store having to have an issue. And again, B2C is 10 years ahead, or let's call it B2SMB is 10 years ahead, especially these auto parts, home construction, these kinds of businesses that have done it.
HVAC, every kind of verticalized business now has its own, it feels like they've all got their own marketplaces, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think one day we'll get to the manufacturers thinking that way. But first, to just have the muscle of building that reputation online and building online commerce relationships and knowing how to service that in a B2B world, it's a little bit more complicated, I think needs to come first.
No, you're spot on. And if we were to look at the demographics, sorry about that. If we were to look at the demographics of your customers, what would be the split roughly between, say, D2C, B2C, and wholesale customers that are trying to establish a marketplace? So effectively, B2B marketplace customers that are trying to build a B2B marketplace on your platform versus a D2C or a B2C brand that are trying to build on your platform. What's roughly the split for you?
So we've got majority B2C, B2B folks. I think the wholesale world is one that's a little bit further out still as a model. And we're obviously still early days as a company. We're young and nimble. And if you want to get to the folks who have a national, international wholesale footprint, it's a longer sales cycle, a larger lift. They have more complicated implementation concerns, problems, goals, you name it. So I think that's something that will probably continue to be a smaller chunk of what we do until I think the market catches up a little bit. And obviously we gain the kind of scale to start working with some of the really big boys. I think we can handle them. I think we can work very well with systems like that. I think we have an extremely scalable platform, although I want to avoid going too deep in the tech point, but I think we have the scalability and the tools to do it. But I think it's a little bit further out as a market.
But obviously you do see it as a market that is worthy of pursuing, because you did have a booth at B2B Online Florida, and you do see that wholesale marketplace opportunity as being significant enough that you want to keep nurturing it. You want to keep having those discussions. And obviously those brands in particular tend to be stickier. They tend to have bigger catalogs. They tend to have more money. So I feel like that's a great market. But to your point, I think the B2C and D2C world understand the marketplace model maybe a little bit better than the B2B world currently. So it makes sense that the B2C world would be your kind of bread and butter with B2B as a fast following, hopefully, business model that you would want to tap into. And how do you guys make your money? How do you charge? Is it like almost like a SaaS model where they're paying a fixed fee per month? Are they paying a transactional fee? How do brands onboard your platform into the business and how do they get you paid?
Yeah, just one quick point to what I was saying earlier. We have majority B2B customers today.
Oh, it's majority B2B.
The part that I'm saying is a laggard is the manufacturer, these manufacturer marketplaces. Right, versus the distributors, right? This is the Honeywells of the world or the Schneiders of the world or the G's of the world building their marketplaces. These like multinational brands, I think that's a little bit of a further ways away, but it's majority B2B today. So that's a very important focus for us. With the way that we charge, we have two models, which is one, which depending on how effectively the CFO wants to look at it and also depends on the growth plans of the customer. One is flat fee, we don't take a transaction model, which starts to scale as the customer scales, but obviously not linearly, otherwise that's not what you want. And then we have another model, which is typically more interesting to small companies, which is much smaller fixed fee. And like standard commerce systems will have a percentage of the revenue, the sales that they make, which allows them, especially smaller companies, to effectively grow on a value share basis, as opposed to laying everything out immediately. Because they have great businesses, but are typically more cash constrained. They have less access to financing. They typically have more difficult working capital situations and all these kinds of things. So the ability to have, let's call it the variable model, is obviously a little bit more appetizing.
Makes complete sense. And how long, I know this question is always a tough one because it's how long is a piece of string, but for your merchants on average across all the merchants you've onboarded into your platform, how long does it take if they sign on the dotted line today? Are they going to be up and running on your platform typically in 12 weeks, 16 weeks? Is it a 5-month build? Is it a 6-month build? Again, I know this is difficult because it depends on how many products they're bringing into the platform, how many vendors they're bringing into the platform, what is the availability of data, and how are we going to get it into the platform? I know there's a lot to this, and so I don't want to make it sound like this is a boilerplate response, but based on your experience, if you're bringing a wholesaler or a distributor into your platform and they're trying to onboard, let's say 100 merchants and they're trying to onboard 500,000 products, what are we talking in terms of time? Is this usually a super heavy lift that's going to take them 18 months, or is this a relatively quick build out opportunity where we start with the top 10% of SKUs that are sold by these retailers or whatever, and we bring those in quickly and we take a very much an MVP approach to implementation? What does that typically look like for you guys when you're onboarding a major wholesaler or distributor into the platform?
Yeah, one of the benefits of building this as an end-to-end platform is that in a complete vacuum, totally in theory, we can go and put up the system and it's more or less click of a button, right? And you've got a marketplace platform. So then you have to get your typical stuff, right? Go get yourself a payment processor and a tax engine and things like this. The stuff that a commerce platform should definitely not be touching, especially in this space. But you've gotten going. Now for our system, we're something called headless. We do give people a reference code base so that they can get their 60, 70, 80% of the way to making their storefront. And we're doing lots of work to make that even easier, to make it a little more accessible to folks who are a little bit smaller, maybe don't have the expertise of dealing with something like that. But there's some work to be done there. From our perspective, we can get people the technology very quickly. And then the time to implement is therefore much more heavily skewed towards the project plan of the people that we work with. Now, we try to be pretty helpful as we can to sort of see through all the different experiences that we've had, what is best practice for being able to get this stuff done, because nobody wants an 18-month project. That is a great way to get fired. It's a great way to spend a lot of money and not learning anything. One of the things that Silicon Valley has become so damn good at is this concept of being lean, right? You try it, you learn, you optimize, you get better. I'm doing these big projects and boil the ocean from the beginning. All that happens is you create all these requirements in a vacuum. You think you're confident about them. You should probably be less confident than you are. And you only find out it all went pear-shaped when the rubber meets the road, or what really the asks are. So we typically try to get people to get smaller. Now, we've had a variation of speeds of implementation. We've had, I think, our fastest managed to get it all going. They're obviously a little bit smaller. I think managed to get it all going within 3 weeks or something of signing. Crazy short period of time. They were online, they were transacting, right? I think the longest one that we've seen, probably north of a year, but typically we'll guide people to 3 to 6 months, is how much they should budget for themselves to be able to get all their ducks in a row and get their suppliers ready and get the motion right for how they should onboard suppliers, make sure that their shopping experience is up to scratch. Because often there's a fair amount of changes that they need to make for the way that they work. And everything is people, process, and technology. Quite honestly, the technology is the most predictable part. People and process is typically the least predictable part, especially when you're working with a huge community of vendors. That's where we orient them to target. And typically we'll try and help guide them. And this is a little bit where I can be helpful. And with customers where I'll sometimes come into the early stage relationships, is to help them focus down with a really aggressive, this kind of Silicon Valley attitude of let's cut and focus and get something out there that works. And across commerce, you see this in all kinds of other commerce systems too, that the longer the implementation takes, the more likely it is to fail or to never get off the ground. That is an iron rule across all things B2B software. All the ERP folks will tell you the same thing. And obviously we want to avoid that both for them and for us. And that's one of the big reasons, again, to one of the questions you had earlier, for why we built this as a standalone platform, right? Because the moment you try to bolt multiple systems together and you start to build one of these sort of Frankensteins, the moment you start to build a kit car, it all takes so much longer. And there are so many extra hidden costs and so much extra training and so much extra weaving together, that one of the big benefits of our system, and it can all go so much faster when it's an end-to-end thing that they can get going with. And if they so wished to start to add bits to it and start to say, you know what, actually, I will come with my own PIM over time, right? Or I will come and build the whole storefront myself, or I'm going to use your APIs, which some people have done, to build out a huge amount of the, especially the seller experience, to be custom to my industry. They can go and do that, but they don't have to do it from day one. It's something that can be really iterative with our system.
Makes complete sense. Well, Nick, it sounds like you've built a very complete system, because I know that if, as you say, the bulk of your merchants that are working with your platform are wholesalers and distributors, I know that there's a whole new level of functionality that is required to serve that market versus the B2C or D2C market. So you've obviously built something pretty special if the bulk of your clients are wholesalers and distributors. So it must be a very impressive platform. In all transparency, with my audience, I haven't ever worked with or used or deployed Nautical before. So it's great to hear your story. Great to hear your story about how the tech came to be, what's involved, how customers can get onboarded into the platform, et cetera, what that looks like. Now, as we come down to the end of our time together, and I really appreciate your time and sharing your expertise with me and the audience, I like to turn the microphone over. I like to flip the script. I like to let my guests ask me one question, any question they like, can be personal or professional. So Nick from Nautical Commerce, what is your question for me today?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that's important to us, me particularly, is I have a passion for helping people build businesses and helping, particularly in this world, marketplaces be more successful, right? And avoid pitfalls. So as a result, and this is a little bit of me talking my own game here, so I apologize, is we're going to start rolling out or start filming or recording a podcast specifically for the nitty-gritty of marketplace operations. And now you've been running a successful podcast for a very long time. What's your advice for starting one? What would you like to hear in a podcast that goes in and really helps the people on the front lines that are doing the hand-to-hand marketplace combat.
Man, this is, first of all, killer idea. Second of all, killer question. Look, I'm not aware. There may be another one out there, but I'm literally not personally aware of any podcast out there that gets into the nitty-gritty of marketplace operations, like what a merchant has to go through, what vendors have to go through to get themselves ready to be onboarded into marketplaces. I'm not aware of any podcast out there that discusses this. So first of all, genius idea. I think that there's such an open white space or blue ocean space or whatever you want to call it. I think there's a massive gap in the market for this type of information, showing the warts and all, the non-pretty side of marketplace operations, because it does require some dedication. There is no such thing as a silver bullet. There's no such thing as fire and forget. There's no such thing as wind up this clock and just let it run. Brands will need to understand that this is a dedicated sales channel, independent of your own maybe direct e-commerce channel, and independent of EDI, independent of Punch Out, independent of all these other channels that these brands can execute on, independent of the store state. And I think that sometimes brands that think about setting up a marketplace are under the illusion that this is going to take almost no effort on their part. And I would say that the data component, the product data component, and the customer data component are the two things that I find in my own consulting really trip up B2B brands in the first place. Like they, especially if they're doing e-commerce for the very first time outside of EDI and PunchOut, and they're setting up self-service e-commerce for the first time, I will usually go into their business and the first thing I'll ask for, show me a sample of your product data and show me a sample of your customer data. And I can usually identify very quickly within about an hour, I can usually identify where all their pain points are going to be in terms of adopting e-commerce into their business. And I'm sure you're similar. It's look, okay, what does, do we have any kind of rationalization of our product data and our customer data? Is there any kind of consistency there? Is there any kind of rules there? Do we have any kind of consistent product attribution? Do we only have unstructured data, or do we have some structured data, some unstructured data? These are the kind of conversations I'm having every day. And I think that especially when you're going to go into marketplace operations, having your data engineering and your data design absolutely nailed is going to be so critical, not only for your business, but for the other vendors to be able to give them templates that they then can supply their data in a standardized way so you can create a standardized customer experience on the front end of the marketplace. This is the thing that's going to trip people up. So I would say it's probably less important to understand the technical part of creating a podcast. It's really how can we create the content that is genuinely going to show the guts, the inner workings, the devil is in the details side of standing up a marketplace and what is really going to take for your business to have enough focus on this for a sustained period of time to see it be a success. Because just like e-commerce in general, you're never just going to stand up something and let it run and it's just going to be a success on its own. It requires a sustained investment of time and resources to see it be a success as a standalone channel. And so I would say, look, the technology is out there from a software perspective to record great podcasts from Riverside FM, which we're recording in right now, virtual studio technology, to platforms like Descript, which can take your editing and automate 90%+ of the post-production editing process, to the final video editing software where you can put the intros and the outros. That stuff is all pretty commoditized now, and it's all pretty easy to nail. So I would say probably the content and mapping out the content journey that you're wanting to present in a stacked pyramid kind of a way, where we're going to start with the basics, because there's a lot of people out there that don't even understand the absolute generic basics of what being a marketplace operator is going to look like for them. So starting with the foundations, right? And then building up to the more complex and more nuanced parts of operating and standing up a marketplace. I think the content journey is probably going to be harder for you, defining that and what that looks like and potentially what guests can come in and augment those discussions. That's probably going to be the harder part than the technical part of producing, post-producing, and getting the podcast hosted and distributed to all the podcast engines. And the probably one of the biggest decisions you'll need to make, are we going to be an audio-only podcast, or are we going to be video too? Because if we want to leverage platforms like YouTube and Rumble, you're going to want to do video as well. And then depending on where you host, the host can potentially split out the video and the audio and send the audio component to the likes of Apple Podcasts and Spotify, et cetera. And I moved recently, about a year and a half ago, I moved my hosting from a dedicated podcast host to Spotify because I was approved for video on Spotify, but I had to be hosted by them. And I moved my hosting, and the benefit was I was spending several thousand dollars a year with my dedicated podcast host, and hosting on Spotify was free. And Spotify does the splitting. So I upload the video podcast to them. They do the splitting. They produce the MP3 that automatically goes to the likes of Apple and their own platform for audio podcasts. So the technical side is probably the easiest part. It's the content journey and experience you're trying to create that is the harder part.
That makes total sense. Otherwise, it was really nice meeting you. When you start to build your marketplace for your e-commerce edge community with all things recommended, certified Jason Greenwood gear, give us a call. And it was very nice to meet you. And next time, we're making a podcast on our mutual passion for motorsport, I hear.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe that could be your foundational episode. Get completely off topic from episode one. But Nick, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. How do you like people to get a hold of you? I'll put links to both Nautical and your LinkedIn profile in the show notes. But how do you like people to get a hold of you if they want to have a discussion with you about marketplaces?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can reach out to me at nicholas@nauticalcommerce.com, and look forward to hearing from everybody and anybody.
Fantastic. Nick, thank you so much for your time. Can't wait to have you again on the podcast soon. Cheers, mate. Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.